America's eclipse goes global today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. That total solar eclipse that made its way across the country today, it's not just news in the U.S.
We talk, say, solar eclipse, you follow all America road.
That's how they heard the news in West Africa via the BBC's new Pidgin English service. And the Vatican's top astronomer says the eclipse is a work of wonder.
It's just one of those lovely tricks of the universe that has to make you smile.
Plus, President Trump is about to unveil his new plan for Afghanistan. Here's what one Afghan expects.
It will cost lives on both sides. The Afghan sides, the American sides, and the Afghan people will suffer in between, and the country will get destroyed every day.
All that coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. President Trump speaks to the American people directly tonight in a primetime address to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. Now, contrary to his campaign speeches, he's expected to announce an expansion of the U.S. military role there. The 16-year-old war in Afghanistan is far from won. In fact, the Taliban and other rebel groups are gaining ground, while the government in Kabul is showing signs of fraying around the edges. Afghan writer Qais Akbar Omar is author of A Fort of Nine Towers, an Afghan family story about his life growing up there and escaping the Taliban. Qais now lives here in Boston. So welcome back, Qais. Good to see you.
Thank you.
What would you like to hear from Trump tonight?
I would like to hear what are his plans regarding Pakistan. And also I would like to hear whether he will have a dialogue with our neighbors, such as Iran and Russia. As long as you have those people unhappy, they are not going to let you stay there like that. The Russians don't like the American presence in Afghanistan. They're basically in their backyard. The same with Iran and China there as well. So, I mean, war is not the solution in Afghanistan. No one wins in Afghanistan. Alexander the Great did not win. Genghis Khan did not win. Englishmen came three times. They did not win. Russians lost. Why do you think American military will win this war there? As long as, you know, we have all the neighbors who are unhappy, they will continue to fund the Taliban, groups like ISIS, and this can go on.
Why do you think successive administrations in the White House don't seem to pay enough attention to that history? You talked about Alexander the Great and
right.
Genghis Khan, and nobody's able to kind of pacify Afghanistan from the outside. Well, isn't there a lesson there?
Well, I'm confused too, like yourself. Like, do we have anyone there who actually understand the country, the people, the history? Or do they have time to just go online and read the Wikipedia and get a sense of what has been going on for the past, forget, you know, the thousands of years of history, but the past 40, 50 years?
What about your friends and family back in Afghanistan? What are their thoughts on the future?
Oh, well, some of my friends and family members are leaving the country. They think that the future is very bleak and there is nothing for them, nothing left. However, some of my friends and family members, they want to stay there. They are very optimistic and hopeful.
What gives them hope? What gives them the optimism?
The new generation, the millennials. Some of them have had a chance over the past 20 years to go outside of Afghanistan and get an education and come back to the country. And they're trying to build their own businesses, try to help other men and women get education. So that's they're very hopeful to, you know, and try to start businesses. And also the social media had a huge effect over the past 20 years. Now people have access to TV and they can watch TV shows from across the world, from places like Turkey. And it's a Muslim country, but they don't wear headscarves. They're not very conservatives, you know, and then they can see that, okay, this is a Muslim nation, and then India, and then America, and the rest of the world. So they see how the world is changing.
For those millennials to keep that hope and optimism, they're going to have to see some changes, though. Will they see changes with 4,000 additional troops? Will they... How much patience will they have?
I wonder whether they will see any changes with the 4,000 troops. I think the current situation, I believe, will continue. You know, everyday suicide bombers, Taliban. But they, you know, when I talk to them, they think that once they start building, people will not go towards extremism. So the whole thing comes down to economy.
Afghan writer Qais Akbar Omar. He's the author of A Fort of Nine Towers. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Later on the show, we'll have a lot more on the president's primetime address on Afghanistan tonight. First, though, the other big story today. That was a reaction today from people watching the total solar eclipse in Denton, Nebraska. And by the sounds of it, it did not disappoint. Kathy Shrout watched from Sweetwater, Tennessee. She'd been waiting for this moment for more than 50 years, ever since she first learned of this eclipse as a 10-year-old in Kentucky. So, Kathy, we spoke with you on the show last week, and now I got to know, did this eclipse live up to your expectations?
Oh, more than my expectations. It was magnificent. I've never seen anything like it in my life, and it just makes me want to go see the next one.
Yeah, I'll bet.
We were lucky enough to get next to an astronomer that had a telescope, and we got to see the sun close up, sunspots and everything. And the crescent-shaped shadows were there, and the diamond ring was there, and Bailey's Beach was there, and it was just magnificent.
Wow. So, I mean, you just described so many different things that happened during an eclipse. Is there one moment that really kind of took you away?
Two of them. The diamond ring, I've never seen anything that can compare to that. And when it got dark, having dark in the middle of the day, and the crickets went off, and it was just, you could have heard a pin drop. It was so quiet in this crowd of people, and it was just silence. It was beautiful.
So you have been waiting for this eclipse today for a long time. How do you feel now that it's over?
Oh, I'm still high from it. I mean, I'm just, this is going to last a while. I'm not coming down for a while from this. I mean, I'm not. It just makes me want to go see the next one. I've already got the date memorized. I'm going to start planning for it.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, so you're hooked on it now. And so I don't know whether you'll be in Kentucky or Tennessee, but are you trying to figure out how you're going to witness that one?
Well, it's supposed to hit the very edge of Kentucky on the western end, so we'll probably go out around there. Maybe the Indianapolis is supposed to put Indianapolis in the dark that time, and it's supposed to last about twice as long as this one.
Well, I'm
eagerly anticipating.
I'm so glad it worked out for you today. Clear skies and everything. Kathy Shrout there, fulfilling a childhood dream today by watching the eclipse with her family in Tennessee. Kathy, thanks for being with us on this special day for you.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Science reporter Ari Daniel with our partners of the PBS television series Nova watch the eclipse on the other side of the country in Idaho. Ari, where exactly are you and what's the crowd there like?
I'm in Cascade, Idaho, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of Boise. And there was an incredible turnout of a couple hundred people that came from different parts of the country in order to watch the eclipse here.
So tell me what it was like. What did you experience?
I was totally unprepared, and I've been reporting on this for the last couple of months. I mean, I've heard people describe it, but there is nothing that comes close to being able to see this glowing ring of light in the sky. So there's all this suspense that's building up. You know, it's 10 minutes until totality, 5 minutes. Look at the ground. You're going to see these kind of racing ribbons of light. And then all of a sudden they say, take your glasses off. And you look up and it's just this beautiful kind of ring of light that's streaming off from the sun. It was breathtakingly beautiful.
Yeah, you never really are prepared until it happens. So who was around you when the actual totality started? Like, what happened?
Well, I was surrounded by a couple hundred other people. But when it was announced that we could take our eclipse glasses off, there was a cry from the crowd that went up when we looked into the sky. So here's what that sounded like. Everyone was very excited, and afterwards I caught up with John Llewellyn, who's originally from Southampton, England, but lives in Boise now.
That was the most extraordinary experience. I am totally flabbergasted, awe-inspiring. We never see that. We always assume the sun is going to be shining, and suddenly the sun is gone. I can understand how the ancients thought that they'd been eaten by a great space monster.
How was the traffic? Because I know there was a lot of concern about traffic jams and congestion, and Idaho was a pretty popular destination for people to watch this eclipse.
We did not run into any trouble. I was concerned about that, Marco, but at least where we flew into in Boise, there was no traffic, and the conditions here were incredible. The sky was completely clear. There's no place else I'd rather have been.
The celebrity astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted today that this eclipse is uniting a divided America. Is that something that really seems to have motivated people to travel to watch this eclipse?
I think it was the eclipse itself, the spectacle in the sky, that really drove people here. In fact, here's Sandra Cuneo, who came up from L.A., who I spoke with yesterday before the eclipse.
It brings into focus our infinitesimally small place in the universe, and for just 2 minutes, you forget, perhaps, the quotidian life and see, for a moment, the infinite universe.
Was there anything that surprised you about this eclipse, or just the experience of watching it?
Because I've watched videos of an eclipse, I've had an image in my head of what it would look like, but I feel like it was like low res. And when I saw it today, it was so crisp, so bright. It was brought up to this high def surround experience in all senses. I mean, for me, that was what was so magnificent.
Well, I'm really glad you got to witness this, Ari. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. Me too.
Ari Daniel reporting from Cascade, Idaho, for our partners at NOVA. Their TV special Eclipse Over America airs tonight on PBS after the president's address. Some things don't get eclipsed. Now, we tend to think of science as antithetical to religion, but go to the Vatican and you'll find that science and religion get along pretty well and have done for centuries.
Astronomy is a great way to use science to introduce people to the idea that there's more to life than your immediate day-to-day needs, and that's what religion tries to do as well.
That's Guy Consolmagno, Brother Guy, as he's known. He's a Jesuit priest. He's also the unofficial astronomer-in-chief at the Vatican Observatory. Wait, I hear you say, the Catholic Church has astronomers on its payroll? 12 of them, according to Consolmagno, and the church has been paying scientists to look at the stars for a long time.
The whole history of the observatory goes back to the reform of the calendar, but we don't have to do that anymore. That was solved in 1582. Today, we exist simply to be assigned to show the world that the church not only embraces science, but it supports science. It pays for science. Science is a good thing. And the people we have to give that message to more often than not are the religious people, because I found most of my fellow scientists know that already.
The church, of course, has a long history with astronomy, and that includes plenty of mistakes, Consolmagno admits. Just think of Galileo. He was condemned by the Vatican for asserting the Earth revolves around the sun, not the other way around. Yes, there are points where Catholicism and science have fought bitterly. Interestingly, though, for someone who has spent his career looking into a telescope, today was Consolmagno's first total solar eclipse. Yep, left his base at the Holy See for a few minutes in the lunar shadow in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. The town, which sits smack dab on the path of totality, has nicknamed itself Eclipseville. Brother Guy says you don't have to believe in God to appreciate the wonder and beauty, not to mention the science of a solar eclipse. But he does find spiritual meaning in this purely astronomical event.
If you accept that this is the God that we've encountered, you know, in the history of Scripture, and you look at the universe already knowing that whatever's going on out there, that is the expression of this God, then whatever you find out there is a way of learning something about God. The fact that this eclipse is so beautiful, the fact that it's even possible, you know, it's a remarkable coincidence that the moon happens to be in the sky almost exactly the same size as the sun appears in the sky, so that the one can completely block out the other without blocking out too much or too little. Now, is that, you know, proof of the existence of God? Of course not. It's a coincidence. But maybe it's a divine coincidence. It's just one of those lovely tricks of the universe that has to make you smile.
By the way, if you're like me, stuck inside all day, missing that divine coincidence, don't worry. There's another total solar eclipse sweeping across America in 2024. So now is the time to put in your request for time off. Bike sharing, but no bike station. That's next here on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Trump has been trying to undo a lot of President Obama's legacy. That now includes dismantling a small part of Washington, D.C.'s bike sharing program. The Obama administration had one of the program's dock stations installed on White House grounds in 2010. Last week, the Trump administration had it removed. Not sure what the thinking was there, but this I can tell you, not all bike sharing programs use dock stations. In fact, right now, Seattle is giving the concept of dockless sharing a try. It's a new concept for Americans, but it is already huge in China. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
Seattle had a bike sharing program. It didn't work so well, though. It lasted 2.5 years before it went under in March. Seattle's hills and rain didn't help. But Tom Fucoloro, founder of SeattleBikeBlog.com, says the real culprit was the system. This being Seattle, we met in a coffee shop.
It was hard to make use of it. Like, it was rarely where you were and where you were trying to go to.
And it was also controversial because the city bailed out a failing nonprofit enterprise. This time, Seattle is trying bike sharing with no taxpayer money and no docks, those stations where you find and return a bike. The new dockless system is off to a hot start, more than 15,000 rides in the first week.
We're about to see a real transportation revolution in the city. I mean, huge, huge increase in the number of trips being taken by bicycle.
Two Bay Area startups, Spin and Lime Bike, have each sprinkled 500 bright green and orange bikes throughout Seattle's downtown sidewalks. It's quickly getting competitive. The Chinese company Ofo, which bills itself as the world's largest stationless bike sharing company, also just received a city permit to add 1,000 yellow bikes into the mix. 31-year-old Derek Koh co-founded Spin. His bikes are the orange ones.
Just $1 per 30 minutes. You can download our app, add your payment information, scan any bike that you see on the street, and it'll automatically unlock and you can start riding.
We take out our phones and see about 25 bikes within a few blocks.
Okay, so now I see one is
right down the street there.
We walk half a block and find a bright orange bike parked on the sidewalk. I scan a code on the back of my bike, and moments later,
wow!
Now you can ride them.
That was super exciting.
After my rather nerdy reaction to a bike magically unlocking, we were off, riding through Seattle, happy as could be. When we reached our destination, we just locked the back tires manually and left the bikes parked right out front on the sidewalk. This concept, dockless bike sharing, has exploded in China over the past 2 years.
You'll get an unlock code immediately. It's very easy and simple.
Now there are literally millions of these bicycles on the streets in China, and it has really transformed the urban living experience.
Paul Gillis is a business professor at Peking University in Beijing. He says for short trips, for that last mile going from the train station to his office, he grabs a bike.
Much easier than trying to hail a car. The bad part has been that the literally millions of bicycles that are now in China litter the streets. And the sidewalks have become so crowded with these bicycles that it's hard to walk around.
Bike sharing in China might be poorly regulated. Still, Gillis feels that it's been a huge positive overall. It's easier to get around and there's less traffic and pollution.
I think it's one of the things that has changed my life in China for the better more than anything else in the last 20 years that I've been there.
Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien, who chairs the city's Committee of Sustainability and Transportation, says adopting the Chinese bike share model makes a lot of sense.
Congestion in Seattle, not unlike major cities, is bad and getting worse.
He adds that Seattle strives to be a leader battling climate change, which means getting more fossil fuel burning vehicles off the roads. As for bicycles junking up Seattle's sidewalks, O'Brien isn't worried. If problems arise, it's up to the bike companies to correct them.
These companies want stories that say, I went and visited Seattle. I used company X. It was a great system. It worked really well. If there's a headline article that says, you know, Seattle shuts down company X because they don't play by the rules, that can be pretty damaging to their brand.
The companies operating in Seattle have trucks patrolling the city, picking up and repositioning the bikes so they're more equally distributed. Still, it's hard to find one on top of Seattle's hills because people ride them down. The challenge, for now at least, isn't cluttered sidewalks. It's not enough bikes.
500 bikes is not nearly enough for downtown.
That's Derek Koh again. He eventually wants to get permits for 10,000 bikes in Seattle. When we tried to go for a second ride, we got out our phones and only found one bike a couple of blocks away. We walked to the spot, but no bike. I asked Ko, where is it?
So it could be a bunch of factors, and it's something that we're always looking to improve on. One being that the GPS inaccuracy. Second could be someone hoarding the bike.
The bike showing up on my map could be 10 floors above in somebody's apartment.
Of course, we would rather they share the bike. It's bike sharing.
But remember, Seattle is the laboratory for U.S. cities trying out dockless bike sharing, and Ko freely admits they're working out the kinks. But he and other bike sharing advocates believe that if they can make things work in hilly, rainy Seattle, they can make it work in your town, too. For The World, Jason Margolis, Seattle.
Jason's story is part of our 50 state series. If you want us to visit your city, just tweet us at PRI The World using the hashtag 50 states. That's hashtag 50 states. Okay, you may have heard about this eclipse thing today, maybe. If you did get a chance to look at it, I hope you were wearing your special glasses. Writer Deepak Singh certainly wore his to watch the eclipse in Tampa, Florida.
Yesterday, on Sunday evening, I got a text alert for my daughter's elementary school. It was a safety message that said, "It is dangerous to look directly at the sun during the eclipse." The last three words were all in caps with an exclamation mark. "Don't look up." The message from the school made me think of my experience of a solar eclipse in India as a kid. I must have been 10 years old. I have a very clear memory of the solar eclipse. Not the memory of watching the eclipse, but a memory of not watching it. No special glasses for me back then. No wall-to-wall media coverage explaining the safe way to witness this amazing natural phenomenon. In fact, my parents made sure I didn't step out of the house at all when the eclipse happened. They also made sure not a single ray of sunlight came into the house that day. They draped the windows and doors with heavy curtains, sealed the cracks with newspapers and bedsheets. They told us if we saw the light outside during the eclipse, we could lose our eyesight. So, I stayed indoors for most of the day and played board games with my siblings. We only opened the curtains and windows when it was well past sundown. When I went out, it was totally dark, and I saw people slowly coming out of their homes. It wasn't just my family. The entire neighborhood had stayed indoors too. I never questioned why and how one could go blind just by looking out during an eclipse. If I did, I don't remember the answer. Yesterday's automated warning from my daughter's school explained it a little bit. Maybe my parents were told the same thing, but they took it a little too seriously, and it left a big impression on me. I still don't look at the sun directly, but today I did, with my eclipse glasses on, and I did not go blind.
Deepak Singh is a writer based in Boston. He watched today's eclipse in Tampa, Florida, where the sun was 81% obscured by the moon.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump will address the nation this evening. He's going to lay out his military plans for Afghanistan.
You've got decades of war that's torn a country apart, and we're going to send 4,000 people to help the Afghan army do what exactly? I don't see an end goal here.
An Afghan war vet weighs in. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A major development today in the wake of last week's terror attack in Barcelona. Spanish police had been hunting for days for the main suspect, the man they suspected of driving a van into pedestrians along Las Ramblas, the famous tourist district in Barcelona. Today, they apparently got him. I got the details earlier from reporter Guy Hedgeco.
Today, the Catalan police up in the northeast of Spain have shot
a man called Yunis Abu Yaqub. He's a man that they've been hunting since last Thursday because they believe he was the man who carried out the attack in a van that ran over people in the central of Barcelona, killing 13 of them. They've been hunting him ever since. And they've just confirmed that the man they've shot in the town of Subirats, which is just outside Barcelona, it's very near, is indeed Yunis Abu Yaqub. So the manhunt is over. We don't know any more than that at the moment.
How firm is that connection between Yunis Abu Yaqub and the attack last week in Barcelona?
Well, it seems to be very firm indeed now. The police say that this man that they were looking for was definitely the driver of the van. For the last few days, there had been some doubts. We knew that the police suspected that that might be the case, but that theory seems to have gained weight more and more. And today they actually confirmed that. They said it was definite. He was the man who carried out that attack. But then, of course, there was another attack just a few hours later, which was related, in which five people drove through the town of Cambrils, which is elsewhere in Catalonia on the coastline. And they killed one person and injured six, including a police officer. That occurred just a few hours after the initial attack. But both of those were related. The five people in that car who carried out that second attack were all shot dead by the police.
Now, the scene of the shootout today in which Yunis Abu Yaqub died sounded very dramatic. Can you give us a few more details about that? I mean, he came out wearing what was thought to be a suicide vest, yeah?
Well, that's right. And we still don't know for sure if it was. What we've heard from local media is that apparently it was a fake suicide belt. What we've heard is that a local person in this town of Subirats, it's quite a small town, identified Yunis Abu Yaqub in the street. The police today had put out pictures of him from CCTV footage from last week, from just after the attack. In Barcelona, asking people to look out for this man. They didn't know where he was, if he was in Catalonia or other parts of Spain or even possibly abroad. And this woman in Subirats saw him today. She apparently shouted out when she identified him. He ran off. And then the local police came in, the so-called Mossos d'Esquadra, who are the regional police force. They were called in and then they shot him.
What do we know at this point about Abu Yaqub?
Well, we know that he is part of a Muslim community in the town of Ripoll, which is about an hour and a half's drive north of Barcelona. And it's a town which has about 600 or so people from a Moroccan background. Some of them are first generation immigrants, but others are children of those immigrants. And several people involved in this plot, seven young men involved in this plot, according to police, come from that town, as does an imam as well, who's suspected of involvement in all of this. And Yunis Abu Yaqub, I mean, I was up in that town the other day on Saturday speaking to local people. They didn't suspect anything like this at all. I heard from some relatives of his mother and a cousin of his. They said he didn't suspect this at all. They didn't know that he was being radicalized. They thought he was a good, disciplined boy, that he was not unhappy in any way. They didn't see any signs of radicalization, but they did blame this imam in the town specifically.
Reporter Guy Hedgeko in Madrid. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure.
And one update since I spoke with Guy. Spanish police now confirm that the imam suspected of radicalizing the young men involved in this case, he died last week. They say he was killed in an explosion hours before the Barcelona attack. According to the authorities, the group had been preparing a larger attack when the explosives they were working with went off. Almost 2 weeks after Kenya's national election, they're still arguing over the results. Officially, incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta won re-election with roughly 54% of the vote. But opposition candidate Raila Odinga says the vote was rigged, and he's now asked Kenya's Supreme Court to weigh in. Odinga's decision to challenge the results through the courts rather than through street protests helped ease tensions in the country and avoid the kind of election-related violence that Kenya has experienced before. We'll keep an eye on that court challenge going forward, but today there's another election story out of Kenya we want to tell you about. On voting day earlier this month, reporter Brenna Daldorf visited a unique polling station for inmates. Here's her story from Nairobi.
Good morning.
Jambo.
How are you?
When I stepped into the main courtyard of Kamiti Maximum Prison, I saw voters sitting comfortably in plastic chairs under the shade of two white tents.
They are very well arranged, seated, and systematically moving for the voting.
That's the head honcho of Kamiti Prison, Henry Kisingu. There's even entertainment.
I have my small DJ there to entertain my prisoners.
DJ Oxygen is a prisoner who doubles as the resident DJ at Kamiti. He pairs his mandatory orange sweater and striped trousers with big, gaudy rings. But the most exceptional thing is the voters themselves. They're all inmates at Kamiti Maximum. That's because this year, for the first time ever, prisoners in Kenya were allowed to vote for president, a democratic right that prisoners in most American states don't enjoy. I'll get back to voting day at the prison in a moment, but first, let me give you the backstory. For that, I met up with John Muriri. He works at Kitua Cha Sharia, a Kenyan legal aid foundation that runs a nationwide program training prisoners to be paralegals. He tells me that it all started in 2010, when Kenya held a referendum on a new constitution. Prisoners petitioned and won the right to vote on it. Fast forward to 2013, the country was gearing up for a presidential election. That's when some of the prisoners turned paralegals came to Kitua Cha Sharia for help. They wanted to vote in this election, too.
So they approached us, having read the Constitution, and seeing that there is nothing that stops them from voting. Because if you look at the law under the Constitution, it's very clear that every citizen in Kenya has the right to vote. And that's when they came to us, and the reason why we filed the case on their behalf.
A court ruled in their favor, but by then it was too late to register for the 2013 elections. They had to wait until this year, 2017. At the prison, on election day, things went smoothly. Well, mostly. This year, the Kenyan Electoral Commission set up a special biometric system to identify voters. The machine at Kamiti was a little finicky. But usually, if people wiped their hands a few times and kept trying, it eventually worked. The head of Kamiti, Officer Kisingu, was already planning improvements for next time. But in general, he's pleased.
Honestly, I'm very glad to see that they can exercise their constitutional right. Yes. And therefore, they also feel that they have been treated as human, as national Kenyans and citizens of this country. It's an exercise that makes you feel you belong here. You belong to this country and you are respected as well.
Case in point. After voting, Albert Couture was beaming.
I'm really happy today. It is one of the most happiest days. It's a privilege, a great privilege, to having gotten this opportunity to vote.
Couture is one of the most civically active inmates at Kamiti. He helped found the education system within the prison. He also serves as the principal of Kamiti Academy, which offers inmates everything from primary level education up through higher learning certificates. He says he and his fellow inmates have been watching the election closely.
Well, we are connected. We have the television in our room. So after job, after duties, we go back to the residential block and we can be able to see the news. We have also permission to read newspapers.
He says he devours 3 papers a day. This time, Couture says he voted on economic issues, but he hopes his vote will get other issues on the table, like sentencing reform. Kenya may have given prisoners the vote, but its legal system still has vestiges of 19th century British colonial law, including a mandatory death sentence for murder, treason, robbery with violence, and even attempted robbery with violence. This affected Couture personally.
Before I was in the death row, I was facing the hangman's noose. So I was there for like almost 10 years in the waiting chambers, waiting for the hangman.
Kenya actually hasn't executed anyone since 1987. But even if you know that, sitting on death row is still excruciating. And more prisoners are being sentenced to death all the time. Couture is no longer one of them. In 2009, his sentence was commuted to life in prison during a mass presidential pardon. His hope is that politicians will start paying attention to sentencing reform now that prisoners can vote.
Of late, no one has talked about abolishment of the death penalty, but we are looking for the issue to be addressed by one of the presidential candidates.
For those at Kamiti, getting the vote is just the beginning. For The World, Brenna Daldorf, Nairobi.
The BBC launched a new online service for West Africa today. It's entirely in Pidgin, an informal mix of English and local languages that's spoken widely in Nigeria and other countries in the region. It's estimated that millions of people in West Africa use Pidgin every day, especially young people. Bilkisu Laburan is the BBC's editorial lead in Nigeria. She's setting up three new language services for Nigeria, including Yoruba and Igbo. But we want to talk to you, Bilkisu, about the Pidgin service. Can you just start by speaking a little Pidgin? Like, tell me in Pidgin, what is your headline today for the total solar eclipse?
Marco, you want here, say make I talk Pidgin for you, eh? That solar eclipse story, we carry on for our Pidgin website. We talk, say, solar eclipse, it follow all America road, and it won't reach West Africa. So people say for West Africa, them fit see them.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think it made a little sense. I obviously caught a total eclipse in there and West Africa. So am I wrong to think that Pidgin is, I mean, it is one of the most widely spoken languages in West Africa, but it sounds like it's a mix of English and some local languages.
You're absolutely right, Marco. Yes, Pidgin started 500 years ago when the first slave traders set foot on the West African coast. Obviously, arriving here, they needed a language to communicate with the locals. And so Pidgin kind of started developing as a mix of European languages and indigenous languages. And it continued to grow and grow to what it is today, which is a Pidgin. And in fact, in some parts of the region, it has become a proper Creole. So it's a first language to a few million people, but it's a lingua franca or language of communication to many, many millions more.
So I didn't know Pidgin has this association with slavery. There's no negative connotation with the slave trade?
You're right. You know, Pidgin has had negative connotations for a long time. When I was a kid in school, we used to get beaten, actually physically beaten for speaking Pidgin, because at the time the attitude was that Pidgin is bad English, is wrong English. But actually, it turned out that Pidgin is a language that has withstood the test of time. One of the fantastic things about Pidgin is its fluidity, its constantly changing nature, its flexibility in terms of the grammar that you use. And therefore, over the years, I guess it kind of developed and people kind of accepted it as a language of communication. And incidentally, now it's got positive connotations. The media are using it. And of course, today the BBC is also getting to the market.
Now, when you were a girl, you were talking about this a second ago. What was your language from birth? I mean, was it Yoruba or Igbo? And obviously there was English too. Where did Pidgin fit in?
I'm Hausa.
Okay.
Hausa is a language that's spoken in the northern part of the country.
And the BBC has a Hausa service, a very active Hausa service.
That's absolutely right. So whether you're Hausa from the north, Yoruba from the west, Igbo from the east, Pidgin unites all of us. When I meet Nigerians abroad, the first thing we want to do is speak Pidgin. You know, nawawo, when we meet one another. Nawawo, how now? How the body, you know? Mm. And you greet and you kind of have a warm feeling. You know, one lady I spoke to in Cameroon said, Pidgin, it just they sweet me for belle. It's just sweet. It's just a fluid, fantastic language. And I just love speaking it.
She meant it's like sweet in your belly?
Yes, sweet for belle means it's just fantastic. It's just great.
Right.
It's just amazing, yes.
That's beautiful. Poetic, too. So since Pidgin is mostly a spoken language, are you going to have trouble writing it out for the website?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Yes, I could be in trouble because we're getting a lot of questions already from people who visited the site. Okay, so how are you going to write this language that is an informal language that has no recognized written system? Well, Pidgin is kind of English-based to a certain extent, so we have English words that creep in here and there. And then we begin to develop our own style. And I see this as an exciting opportunity that the BBC can create the platform for people to have that conversation, to begin to create a consensus as to what the best way is to spell this word or to say this expression.
Do you have a favorite word in Pidgin?
Nawawo, and Nawawo has no translation. It's an expression that just captures everything, whether you're happy, whether you're frustrated, whether you're
all purpose,
whatever your mood, you know, all purpose, you know, Marco,
Nawawo,
you know, Nawawo, that's it.
That's Bilkisu Labaran, who is heading up the BBC's new pigeon service for West Africa. Bilkisu, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
President Trump speaks to the nation tonight, his first formal primetime address since February. He'll be announcing a new plan for Afghanistan, which is expected to include a limited increase in the number of U.S. troops deployed there. The war in Afghanistan is already the longest in American history and shows no sign of being won anytime soon. David Rode knows the conflict intimately. He's reported on it from the beginning in the weeks after 9/11 and was even a captive of the Taliban for 8 months. Rode is now with The New Yorker. What is your sense of the situation in Afghanistan today, David? Like, what is the big headline?
It's deteriorating. The Taliban are taking ground. There's, you know, an unclear American commitment, and the government of President Ghani is increasingly paralyzed.
And so what is your understanding of what President Trump will be announcing tonight?
I mean, the sense is that it will be a modest increase, roughly 4,000 new troops on top of the 8,800 that are there. There might be talk of a diplomatic initiative and an effort to curb corruption, but former American diplomats I've been speaking to today who served in Afghanistan don't expect a large enough diplomatic component in the announcement tonight.
Yes. So how could 4,000 troops, let's say even a few more, how could that impact the conflict in Afghanistan and the region?
That's the problem. I mean, this is a muddle through strategy. Some would argue that it's better to either, you know, make a major troop increase, you know, get closer to the over 100,000 troops that the U.S. had in the past, or pull out. That this kind of muddling through strategy will just lead to more deaths in Afghanistan and no change.
So it sounds like you're saying this isn't really a whole lot different from what his predecessors did, except actually the numbers are lower.
Yeah, the numbers are lower. It's similar to Obama's approach. It doesn't deal with the sort of core issue, which is, you know, an effort to engage with the countries in the region, primarily Pakistan, but also Iran and Russia, that are destabilizing Afghanistan. And until you address that regional dynamic diplomatically, 4,000 troops won't make a difference. And as Barack Obama saw, 100,000 troops won't make a difference.
I mean, not long ago, Trump, the America First president, was the skeptic in chief when it came to Afghanistan. He wanted withdrawal. So this seems like a big shift. Is it a big shift? And what do you think changed his mind?
It's another dramatic reversal. I mean, you know, all politicians make promises, but, you know, President Trump promised to solve so many issues, from jobs to pulling us out of Afghanistan. And it's much more complicated than he portrayed on the campaign trail. If the U.S. was to withdraw, the sense is the Taliban would take over. Beyond that, there would be chaos. And in those pockets of chaos, the Islamic State could take over areas of Afghanistan as well. And you eventually could have the threat of more attacks in the U.S. planned from Afghanistan.
And what about the security threat to those soldiers who are heading to Afghanistan, those 4,000 troops? I mean, does this kind of equate a rise in U.S. casualties, just raising the number?
It could. I mean, the American casualties, though, are very low now. And a single, you know, the loss of a single American service member is tragic. I'm not trying to minimize it at all. But 11 American soldiers have died so far this year. 14 American service members died last year. And this question about do we have allies and are there Muslims who will confront extremism? Last year, 6,000 Afghan soldiers and policemen. I want to repeat that. 6,000 last year alone died fighting the Taliban.
Wow.
They are fighting. They are asking for our assistance. You know, it's not going to be easy in Afghanistan. I don't know when or how we get out, but there will be a rise in casualties in Americans, but the biggest burden is being felt by Afghan soldiers and police.
David Rode of The New Yorker there with his thoughts ahead of President Trump's speech tonight. When the president's expected to announce a limited expansion of U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan.
If the rumors are true and it's only going to be 3,000 to 5,000 people, that doesn't seem to warrant a large announcement to me.
Brian McGough is a combat wounded veteran who served in the initial invasion of Afghanistan.
This is nothing different than has been going on for years in Afghanistan. We send some more people to help. We bring people home. It kind of begs the question, are we looking at this as a distraction? Is this a distraction from the woeful response to Charlottesville? The questions about Russia interference, you know, is this an easy way to say, hey, look at me, I can be a good president?
So is there a number of troops that you think would kind of address some of the underlying problems in Afghanistan? Or it's really, in your opinion, not about troops? It's about something else.
I don't necessarily know that it's about troops without, you know, a stated end goal more than kind of the slogan of end the war on terror or make us safe at home. Are 4,000 troops going to be able to help the Afghan National Army? Sure. Are they going to help them be able to react to things better? Absolutely. Are they going to train them to a higher standard? Absolutely. But are we going to look at the underlying problems?
So what underlying problems did you see that you feel are not being talked about that really need addressing before we talk about 3 or 4,000 troops?
So one of the biggest issues I saw is that there's a lack of infrastructure in Afghanistan that has only been compounded by years and years of war. So that infrastructure makes it hard for people to communicate in certain ways across the country, makes it hard for them to get what they need, and it makes it hard for them to thrive as a country that would be able to, you know, walk away from terrorism or to get away from that type of thinking. And unless we're doing something to help there, we can send more troops, we can, you know, put more boots on the ground, but I'm not sure it's going to help anything. You're trying to change people's minds through the tip of a sword, which, you know, hasn't helped yet, and who knows if it's going to help in the future.
You seem to see the problem in a, I'm not really sure what the word is, but I'll say holistic way. I mean, do you think you're rare among veterans in seeing these connections between all these different kind of forces and dynamics at play in a country like Afghanistan?
I don't think I'm rare among veterans seeing that. I think everyone who's been there knows that it's, you know, a much bigger picture and there's lots more things, whether or not people want to admit it or not. It seems to me to an easy way to kind of rally the country to say, hey, look, let's send more people, support our troops, without saying, hey, this is a really, really complicated issue. And you could say that the end goal is something along the lines of win the war on terror or make us safer or something like that. But what does that mean? We don't really know what the end goal is, and that's a concern.
I mean, President Trump did have a sit-down with General James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, and other people in the military before kind of coming up with this plan that we're about to hear tonight. Don't you think that it's been thought through by people who do know?
Oh, absolutely. I think the generals, you know, have thought it through and have probably tried to give the president as much input as they can. But when it comes down to it, they're also generals. And their job is to essentially follow orders and to make this happen. They may be able to argue about things, but, you know, if the president says, here's what we're going to do, the generals can say, well, here's how we can do it. But there's not a lot that they can do to, you know, say we're not sending the troops or anything like that. And yes, I'm sure that they've thought about it, and there's some really smart generals out there. But haven't really smart generals been thinking about this for, what, years now?
Brian McGough is a veteran who served in Afghanistan and Iraq. President Trump is getting ready to unveil his new plan for the war in Afghanistan in a primetime address tonight. We'll have that for you over at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.